We will have less than a full cargo, which will make it easier to exercise them on deck and keep the holds clean. He stood up and looked down at her. With a rush like a roused fawn, she threw off the blanket that covered her and knelt on the edge of the bunk, seizing him about the waist with both arms. "Mungo," she whispered urgently, "you cannot torture us so." She pressed the side of her face to his chest, feeling the harsh springing curls of his body hair even through the linen of his shirt. "I cannot offend further against my God and my conscience. Unless you free these poor damned souls, then I can never marry you." His expression changed swiftly, becoming tender and concerned. He lifted his hand to stroke the dense, russet locks of her hair, still damp and tangled from the loving of the night. "My poor darling." His lips formed the words soundlessly. But her face was still pressed to his chest, and she could not see his lips. He drew a deep breath, and though his eyes were still marked with regret and his expression sober, his tone was light and casual. "Then it is just as well that I have no intention of freeing a single one of them. For what would my wife say otherwise?" The words took many seconds to make sense to Robert. And then her whole body spasmed. Her grip around his waist tightened and then slowly relaxed. She released him. Slowly she sat back on her heels, naked, in the midst of his disordered bunk, and she stared at him with an expression of desolation and disbelief. "You are married," Robin's voice echoed strangely in her own ears, as though from the end of a long bare corridor. And Mungo nodded. "These 10 years passed," he answered quietly. "A French lady of aristocratic birth, a cousin of Louis Napoleon, a lady of great beauty, who, with the 3 fine sons she has borne me, awaits my return to Bannerfield." He paused and then went on with infinite regret. "I am sorry, my dear. I never dreamed that you did not know." And he reached out to touch her cheek, but she cringed away, as though he held a poisonous serpent in his hand. "Will you go away, please?" she whispered. "Robin," he began, but she shook her head violently. "No," she said. "Please don't say any more. Just go. Go away. Please go away." Robin locked the door of her cabin and sat down at the sea chest, which she used for a desk. There were no tears. Her eyes felt dry and burning, as though blasted by a wind off the desert. She had very little paper left and had to tear the end sheets from her journal. They were speckled with mildew and distorted from the heat and dryness of the highlands and the humidity of the monsoon-ridden littoral. She smoothed out the first sheet carefully on the lid of her writing case, dipped her pen in the remaining half inch of India ink, and headed the sheet with a hand that was calm and unshaken. "The 16th of November, 1860, aboard the slaver Huron." And then, in the same clear, unhurried script, began to write. "My dear Captain Codrington, my trust in an all-merciful providence and my belief in the true and one God and in his gentle Son and our Saviour Jesus Christ convinces me that this will come into your hands while there is still time for you to act. Through a series of incredible adventures and misfortunes, I now find myself devoid of friends and protectors, in the power of the notorious American slave master and trader Mungo St. John. Against both my will and my conscience, I am being forced to act as the physician for this infamous vessel, which is at this moment preparing for the voyage around the Cape of Good Hope, across the Atlantic Ocean, for a port in the southern states of America. As I write, I can hear the doleful sounds from the deck above me, and from the hold below where the poor creatures, 800 forsaken souls in all, wearing only their chains, are being brought aboard and incarcerated for the voyage, which many of them will not survive. We are lying at anchor in a hidden creek, concealed from the open sea by a sweep of the channel and the mangrove swamps, a perfect hideaway for the nefarious business in hand. However, I have been able to study the ship's chart, and from the navigator's markings learn the name of the estuary, and its exact position. The river is the Rio Savi, and it lies 20 degrees 58 minutes south latitude and 35 degrees 3 minutes east longitude. I will do all in my power to delay the sailing of this vessel, though at this moment I cannot think what that will be. If this letter reaches you in time, there will be no difficulty for an officer of your courage and experience to blockade the river mouth and seize this slave ship when she attempts to leave the river. If we have failed before your arrival, then I implore you to follow in the same course as the captain of the Huron must set, to round Good Hope, and I will pray for adverse winds and weather that will enable you to come up with us. Robin went out pouring out the tale of her capture, of the plague that had swept through the barracoons, of her fear and hatred of the slavers, the detailed accounts of their barbaric practices and cruelties, and suddenly she realized that she had filled many pages with her account, and she began her last paragraph. You were gracious enough to express your belief that our destinies were linked in some mysterious way. I know that you share with me the same hatred of this abominable trade, and for these reasons I have made bold enough to appeal to you, confident that you will hearken to my anguished cry. Robin paused again, and then searched swiftly in her pen case, and found the pair of the earring which she had given to Clinton Codrington so many months ago. I enclose with this letter a token of my friendship and trust, which I hope you will recognize, and I will search every day to see the topsails of your fine ship hurrying to give succor to myself and to the other unfortunates who are my shipmates on this cursed and iniquitous voyage. She signed it with her bold, rounded signature, and stitched the folded pages and the single item of cheap jewellery into a square of duck canvas. There was only one address that she had for it. Clinton had told her that he was under orders to call at Zanzibar Island, and she knew that Her Majesty's Consul on the island was a man of substance and integrity, a staunch adversary of the slave trade, one of the few men that her father, Fuller Ballantyne, had ever written about with respect and affection. When she had finished, she tucked the small canvas package up under her skirts and went up on deck. Mungo St. John was on his quarter-deck, gaunt and lean and pale, and he took a step towards her, but she turned from him immediately. "Nathaniel," she called to the boatswain, "I wish to visit the Bugaloo." She indicated the Arab dhow, which was still anchored downstream from Huron. "She's making ready to sail, ma'am." Nathaniel knuckled his forehead. "She'll be gone before we can get across." "She will if you continue talking," Robin told him briskly. "I must see if there is aught they need, the poor devils, before they sail." Nathaniel glanced at his captain, and after a moment's hesitation, Mungo nodded his assent and turned back to watch the stream of slaves coming aboard through the entry port. The Arab captain of the dhow, just strong enough to take his place at the tiller, greeted her respectfully and listened attentively while she spoke. Nathaniel was waiting in the gig, out of sight below the level of the dhow's deck, and Robin made sure that they were shielded from a casual watcher on Huron's deck before she passed the canvas package to the Arab and followed it with a gold English sovereign. "There will be another sovereign for you from the man you deliver it to," she told him, and the Arab bit the coin and smiled wanly as he tucked it into a fold of his turban. "And I am Emetabili, in Duna of 2000. My name is Gandang, son of Muzilikatsi, son of Zulu, and I come with bright spear and a red hat." Zuga understood the words with difficulty, for they were spoken rapidly, in accents that were strange to his ears, but there was no misunderstanding the Induna's intention. His tone was clear, the murderous determination in his voice evident, and around him the circle of long black shields was unbroken and steadfast. Unconsciously, Zuga had straightened, forcing his aching muscles erect, and he held the Induna's gaze without flinching. They stared at each other, and Zuga found himself exerting all his will, all the force of his personality, trying to stay the Induna's spear arm. He knew it needed only for the bright, broad blade to drop, and 200 Amadorda would sweep into the rudimentary camp. It would be over so swiftly. The resistance that Zuga and his tiny band could offer would be so puny that they would not even earn the compliment of disembowelment from the victors. He knew that only his steady gaze and the completely fearless mien that he offered to the Matabele had so far stayed the spear arm. But the silence was drawing out. At any second the spell would snap. He must choose his next action and words as though his life depended upon them, as indeed they did. Gandang watched the strange pale man before him, with his features impassive. Yet, for possibly the first time in his life, while on his father's service, he was uncertain. The man who called himself Bakela had spoken familiar names, Chedi and Manali. They were names that his own father revered. Yet that in itself would not have been enough to stay his hand, for the king's orders were clear. All who entered the burnt land must die. It was more than that. He knew who this man was. The maiden, who he would soon take as wife, had spoken of him. This was the brother of the white woman who had delivered Juba to his care, and who he had called Amakazi, mother. Juba had spoken of the man Bakela as she lay beside him on her sleeping mat. She had spoken of him with admiration and awe, as a mighty hunter of elephant, as a warrior honoured by an all-powerful queen who lived far beyond great waters. Juba had spoken of this man Bakela as a friend and a protector. So, Gandang paused before giving the order, Bulala, kill them. A Matabele Induna is never influenced by the words or whims of a woman. If he has 50 wives, their voices are still as the chattering of the waters over the rocks in the shallow rapids of the Inyati River, and a man does not heed them. Or rather, it must never be apparent that he heeds them. Juba had travelled to strange places and spoken of wonders and witchery, and Gandang, while seeming not to listen, had indeed listened and been impressed. The girl was not only comely and high-bred, but sensible far beyond that mere simpering, giggling sexuality to which he was accustomed in other girls of her age. Gandang was learning that a Matabele Induna is never influenced by the whims and words of a woman, unless those words are spoken and the whims expressed on the privacy of the sleeping mat by a senior wife whose good sense has been proven. Then it is folly not to hearken. For a senior wife can make a man's life unbearable, even if that man is an Induna of 2,000, and the favoured son of the most powerful monarch in Africa. Behind the dark, impassive mask of his handsome face, Gandang was thinking furiously. Instinct and Juba's words had warned him that it would be folly to slay this man. Yet the warriors at his back knew his orders, and if he failed to carry them out, that failure would immediately be construed as weakness, and his treason reported to the king. Before him, the tattered figure took a pace forward, his whole being ludicrously arrogant. Gandang could see no trace of fear in the steady gaze of his strangely coloured eyes. "I come as an emissary to the great King Mzilikatsi, ruler of the Matabele people, and I bring greeting from the White Queen from across the waters." At the words, Gandang felt a small, warm flame of relief. The fact that the white man spoke the language of the people, albeit with a strange accent, made it more plausible that he was indeed an emissary. It was plausible also that this queen of his would want to seek the protection and favour of a king as powerful as his father, and that she should be so ignorant as to send her emissary through the burnt land instead of along the open road from the south. Zuga saw the shift of mood in the Induna's eyes, that tiny crack in his determination. "Wait," he said. "There is something that I have for you." In Zuga's writing case still reposed the impressive handwritten letters, with seals of wax and scarlet ribbon, that had been provided him by the Under-Secretary at the Foreign Office in the usual form. "In the name of Her Britannic Majesty, ruler of Great Britain and Ireland, defender of the faith, to the representatives of all foreign governments or to whosoever it may concern, we do by these presents request and require that our beloved Maurice Zuga Ballantyne be allowed to pass freely without let or hindrance, and that he be afforded that assistance of which he may stand in need. Zuger turned his back on the silent, menacing ranks of spearsmen and walked back slowly through the gap of the skerm of cut thorn branches. Jan Sharut was waiting for him, his face the colour of the watchfire ash. He and the gun-bearers were crouched below the thorn barrier, staring through the chinks with expressions of such utter terror that Zuger felt emboldened in comparison. "Lay down those guns," he snapped, for all the weapons were cocked and primed, and a nervous finger on a hair trigger could let fly the shot that brought a solid black wave of Matabele sweeping through the camp. Gandang suddenly found himself in a position of uncertainty. From being the merciless bearer of the king's justice, he found himself waiting like a timid suitor outside the gate in the thorn barrier, and every second detracted from his dignity. Behind him he heard the stir of one of his men, the soft tap of assegai's spear on hide shield. His men were growing restless already, sensing the passing of advantage to the little group of ragged starvelings they had surrounded. Gandang turned slowly, and his stony gaze passed over the ranks. They froze once more into utter stillness.